today on Against the Grain. Was the revolt of 1776 a noble, principled struggle, or was it something very different? Was it, as Gerald Horn argues, a counter-revolution waged by this nation's founding fathers to defend their right to enslave human beings? I'm C.S. The University of Houston historian discusses his new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. There is the dominant uplifting narrative of the American Revolution, of the creation of the United States of America. And then there is the narrative advanced by Gerald Horn in his explosive new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776. Counter-revolution, you say? What was counter-revolutionary about 13 colonies rising up against royal tyranny, about our founding fathers fighting for independence and liberty? According to Horn, a prominent historian and prolific author, the American revolutionaries were motivated in large part by a desire to defend and maintain the institution of slavery. And so, argues Horn, this nation's traditional heroic creation myth needs to be replaced by a new understanding, a radical understanding, of the importance of slavery to the founding fathers and of their decision to revolt in the face of growing evidence that the colonial power, Britain, was moving toward abolition. Gerald Horn is the Moores Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. He's the author of, among other books, Black Revolutionary, William Patterson and the Globalization of the African American Freedom Struggle, and the forthcoming Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. When Gerald Horn joined me recently in studio to discuss his new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America, I asked him why the Glorious Revolution, which took place in England in 1688, is important to his story.
Well, 1688 is important to my book and to my argument. I think that part of the problem with many previous analyses of the revolt against British rule in 1776 that led to the formation of the United States of America is that these authors tend to start their arguments in the 1770s. And when rebels revolt, oftentimes they engage in behaviors that are not necessarily consistent with their previous behaviors or their subsequent behaviors. And certainly that's the case, I argue, for the successful rebels who fought against London in 1776. I start in 1688 because it led to a step back for the monarchy and a step forward for the rising merchant class. For our purposes here, listeners should know that it led to a weakening of the Royal African Company, which theretofore had been under the thumb of the monarchy and had been in control of the African slave trade. And with the rising power of the merchant class, this led to what I refer to as free trade in Africans. That is to say, there was a kind of deregulation, if you like, of the African slave trade. As a result, merchants, freelance merchants, descended upon the African continent like maniacally crazed bees, chaining and manacling and handcuffing every African in sight and dragging them across the Atlantic, particularly to the Caribbean, because up until the middle of the 18th century, the Caribbean, to wit Jamaica, Barbados, Antigua in particular, in many ways were more valuable to the crown and to London than the North American mainland. But with the flooding into those Caribbean islands of so many Africans, it creates a demographic and political nightmare for the settler class. What I mean is that because the Africans were outnumbering the European settlers, sometimes 10 to 1, 20 to 1, it created favorable conditions for slave revolts. It created favorable conditions for the rise of the Maroons in Jamaica, who, for example, by the 1730s, were not only administering a good deal of the island of Jamaica, but it seemed to some that the colonial project in Jamaica was on the verge of collapse. As a result, you see many European settlers and slave owners fleeing to the North American mainland.
Can you tell us more about the slave uprisings in the Caribbean and also the degree to which not just settlers from those nations moved to North America, but also slaves? Because obviously at some point the number of slaves in North America increased dramatically.
Well, yes. Antigua is particularly key here. You had major revolts by enslaved Africans on the British island of Antigua circa 1709 and circa 1730s. These revolts came within a whisper of succeeding. Succeeding mean the Africans taking over, as they did in what we now refer to as Haiti at the beginning of the 19th century, but really putting fear into the bones of the settler class, which causes them to flee. I mean, these are basically liquidation plots. That is to say, basically massacre all the settlers and then take over, which is fundamentally what happened on the island we now refer to as Haiti between 1791 and 1804.
Can we generalize about the beliefs in relation to slavery of the settlers who ended up in North America? Were they, because of what they were escaping or what they perceived they were escaping, were they particularly pro-slavery? Were they in a mood to consider the power of Africans and thus perhaps be more open to respecting their rights?
There are multiple responses. One, as your comment suggests, it's very striking, in my opinion, how the rebelliousness of the Africans helps to give rise to a nascent abolition of slave trade and abolition of slavery movement, and also helps to give rise to a certain kind of moralizing about the horrors of slavery. That is to say, when you're fearing being massacred at night, it really makes you rethink that institution, which leads to this very serious consideration about abolishing this institution. On the other hand, as I state in the book, the rebelliousness in the Caribbean helps to give rise to this idea that perhaps colonialism and seizing the land of the indigenous peoples on the North American mainland should proceed without African slavery. This leads directly to the formation of the colony of Georgia in the United States in 1733, which was formulated with the idea that no Africans would be allowed. But this did not work out. It did not work out for many different reasons. One, it was not easy to get the Europeans to work in the fields. Secondly, by having Europeans working in the field, the settler class and the grandees of Georgia, in many ways, were just exploiting the kinds of class contradictions from Europe to the North American mainland. And I would also say that when you try to exploit poor Europeans in the fields, it complicated what to me is one of the most important aspects of the colonial project in North America, which is the construction of whiteness. That is to say, how Irish and Scots and English and Welsh, when they cross the Atlantic, somehow their identity changes from an ethnic identity to a racial identity, that is to say whiteness, which is obviously a kind of identity politics that's very useful in terms of welding together these Europeans across class lines to confront the fearsomeness of the indigenous and the fearsomeness of the Africans. What complicated the whiteness project in Georgia also was the fact that the Spanish had a different approach to arming Africans. They had been arming Africans since the 1500s. And this is in the context, as you know, of a religious Cold War between the so-called Catholic powers, Spain and France, and the so-called Protestant power that is Britain. And London, the Protestant power, argued that one of the reasons why the Catholic powers, such as Spain, had to rely so heavily on Africans, and this may be a religiously bigoted argument, I should warn the listeners, is because they said that so many of the men in Spain went into the priesthood that there was a deficit of manpower, so therefore they had to rely more on arming Africans. Whatever the case, they relied more on arming Africans. These armed Africans from Spanish Florida were repeatedly coming across the border and attacking Georgia and attacking South Carolina as well, which helps to give rise to something that was already in motion, which was this sort of noxious attitude towards dark-skinned people, Africans in particular.
And we should say then, Florida at that time was a colony of Spain, correct?
Correct.
And that is one reason why Georgia, they tried to make Georgia all white, because it would be kind of a buffer state, correct, between South Carolina, which was anxious about blacks and what might occur if the blacks rose up, and this Spanish colony in Florida, which was, as you were saying, sending armed Africans into Georgia, into South Carolina.
Correct. And you should know that the city of St. Augustine, the way it characterizes itself today, rightly or wrongly, as the oldest urban settlement on the North American continent. Now, whether that's correct or incorrect, the fact of the matter is that virtually from its beginning, St. Augustine, Florida, which is not that far from Jacksonville, what is today Jacksonville, Florida, is in northern Florida, the northeast coast of Florida, was a citadel for armed Africans. Not only that, but the Spanish oftentimes replenished St. Augustine from the island of Cuba, which, as you know, was also under Spanish rule.
Okay, so you have these armed Africans, in essence, kind of threatening the colonists on the North American mainland. You have uprisings in the Caribbean nations, which are resulting in flows of settlers moving to North America for safety. What about slave resistance within the colonies? Obviously, and maybe we could get back to the population of African slaves in the colonies, in the American colonies, what happened to the numbers of them, and then what happened to their militancy in the 18th century leading up to 1776?
Well, there were also very significant revolts of enslaved Africans on the North American mainland. 1712 in Manhattan, what is now New York City, a significant revolt of enslaved Africans, which I should add, seemingly had the fingerprints of the French in Quebec all over it. That is to say, one of the themes that I put forward in this book is that the Africans oftentimes were not acting alone. They were engaging in a kind of political arbitrage. That is to say, they were oftentimes aligning with the Spanish and the French against the British, because from their point of view, they had to make a determination as to who had the cleanest dirty shirt, if you like. That is to say, all the colonial powers were, quote, dirty, unquote. But from their point of view, they thought they could get a better deal from the so-called Catholic powers, as evidenced by the fact that, as already noted, that the Catholic powers oftentimes were more willing to put arms in their hands, whereas the British settlers on the North American mainland, putting arms in the hands of enslaved Africans was considered to be either a daft or a provocative idea. Similarly, 1739, 1740, probably the bloodiest revolt of enslaved Africans in British colonial history in South Carolina, Stono's Revolt, which has the fingerprints of the Spanish in Florida all over it. Not only that, but there's evidence to suggest that the Africans who rose up and began massacring the settlers in South Carolina were of Angolan origin. Angola, as you know, had been a colony of the Portuguese actually up until 1975, 1976. And these Angolan Africans, as they were designated, also often were Roman Catholic as well. And so given the similarity between the Portuguese language and the Spanish language, many of these Africans spoke Portuguese, many of them, like the Spanish, were Catholic, this also had something of a religious coloration. I should also mention that in New York in 1741, there was another massive slave revolt, and this too had the fingerprints of the Spanish all over it. So what this is leading to is that the settlers, the British settlers, are obviously alarmed in high dudgeon. This is leading to repetitive conflicts between the European powers. What happens, to speed up a little bit, is that the British decide to impose taxes upon the settlers so that they could fund an armed offensive to push the Spanish out of Florida and the French out of Quebec, thereby lessening the pressure on the settlers. In other words, London was going to fight a war for the benefit of the settlers, but then tax the settlers. Well, you know the story. The settlers objected to these kinds of taxes because between 1756 and 1763, this war was largely successful, but it was successful for the settlers. It was not successful for the Africans. I call the so-called 7 Years' War between 1756 and 1763 a world historic defeat for Africans, not only on the North American mainland, but on the continent itself, because as a result of the British victory pushing the French out of Quebec, and of course we still have a lingering national question in Quebec involving millions of French speakers there, and pushing the Spanish out of Florida, which was temporary to a degree, you basically remove the rear bases that Africans relied upon to attack the settlers in Georgia and Carolina and up north to New York. What happens then is that the settlers, the British settlers, under the leadership of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Hancock, and other leading slave owners, go behind London's back and cut a deal with the Spanish and the French to ally with them against the British, and then wage war against the British to push them out of a good deal of their North American holdings, not least these 13 colonies. And then that leads, on, as you know, on July 4th, 1776, the formation of the United States of America.
Now, if the enslaved Africans on the North American mainland were allying themselves with the enemies of London, with particularly Spain, then why didn't the white settlers in North America feel antagonism and get very angry with Spain and not its enemy, London? What turned the tables such that all of a sudden, or maybe gradually, the white settlers on the in mainland North America were upset with London? Because in essence, as you said, the enslaved Africans were allying themselves with the enemies of Britain.
Couple points. One, many of the British settlers, particularly in the South, Virginia, the Carolinas, Georgia, were upset with Spain and wanted to see the backs of Spain, wanted to see Spain ousted from Florida in particular, which helps to give impetus to this so-called 7 Years' War, 1756 to 1763, which leads to the Spanish being ousted. But secondly, one of the stories that I tell in this book is really about the takeoff of capitalism, which is not only fueled by the African slave trade. This system accelerates coming onto the world stage in a big way with the blood of Africans dripping from every pore. But also capitalism, this rising system, had a kind of trans-border ethos. That is to say that some of the settlers were angry with the Spanish and the French, but other settlers were trading with the Spanish and the French. You know the old saying about how certain capitalists would sell us the rope by which we would hang them. Well, that certainly applied to these settlers, or at least some of these settlers in North America. I think that you have to keep in mind that there is a dizzying change of alliances taking place. I mean, for example, I just finished speaking about how many of the Africans were aligned with the Spanish and French against London. But after the formation of the United States, as represented in my book that came out in paperback in 2013, Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans of the British Empire Fight the United States Before Emancipation, after the formation of the United States, the Africans then, they switched sides and started aligning with London, particularly in the War of 1812, when the United States came within a whisper of losing its sovereignty.
My name is C.S. Song. Gerald Horne, H-O-R-N-E, teaches history and African-American studies at the University of Houston. And his new book that we are discussing today is called The Counter-Revolution of 1776. It's published by NYU Press. Tell us how important slavery had become to the economy of the North American colony, and how rich some people, not just in the southern part of the continent were getting off the slave trade?
That is a very good and important question. First of all, the sugar islands, such as Antigua, Barbados, Jamaica, are creating tremendous wealth as sugar enters the diet, particularly of the working class and the elite in the British Isles. And the sugar is being produced in these Caribbean islands and is helping to enrich many of the planter class, who then exert political influence in London, not to mention the islands. Secondly, the African slave trade was tremendously lucrative and tremendously profitable. I mean, sometimes the profits could be as much as 1,700%. Now, as you know, under capitalism, you have capitalists will sell their firstborn for a 1,700% profit. And it's not only how the profits from the African slave trade were bringing Africans across the Atlantic to work in the fields, tobacco fields in the Chesapeake area of what is now the United States, the sugar fields of the Caribbean, thereby creating tremendous wealth. But also these planters and slave traders were oftentimes taking those profits and pouring it into allied industries, shipbuilding, for example, insurance, for example, banking, for example, which is one of the reasons why not only myself but other historians have pointed to the capitalism being fueled in its takeoff by the African slave trade. Not only that, but if you look at a place like South Carolina, where in many precincts the Africans are grossly outnumbering the Europeans, there was a repetitive and a real fear of slave uprisings, which causes the building of infrastructure, such as bridges to cross inlets, such as more roads so that patrols could get to the Africans to try to squash their incipient uprisings. But these bridges and infrastructure and roads was not only useful in terms of dealing with enraged Africans, it was useful in terms of productivity and useful in terms of building an advanced economy. So I think that all of the listeners have to think very carefully about how the capitalism that now exists in what is now the leading capitalist country, the United States of America, was built in no small measure on the backs of enslaved Africans. And at the same time, I think listeners should think very carefully about what were the implications and the consequences of that. For example, when you look at the disproportionately high imprisonment rates of African people of African descent in North America today, when you look at who's disproportionately represented on death row in the United States of America today, if you look at a recent Department of Education report that suggested that black preschoolers were suspended at a higher rate than other preschoolers, I think listeners need to think carefully about the connections between the exploitation of people of African descent and the resultant United States of America, and think about what we routinely refer to as racism and how that grew out of this very ugly scenario of exploitation.
You were saying earlier that Spain was arming Africans, that Spain was basically enlisting Africans in their armed forces, and that was doing some serious damage, or at least threatening the mainland British colonists in North America. What do we need to know about the British use of armed Africans and what that trend, because it is a trend that you document in this book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, the impact of that trend on colonists' attitudes toward the mother country, toward the British crown?
Well, the British were under tremendous pressure to arm Africans because the Spanish were doing so and oftentimes besting the British on the battlefield. Keep in mind that there was a struggle between and amongst these colonial empires. They, of course, were fighting the indigenous people of the Americas, but they were also, that is to say, the Europeans fighting each other. And a particular turning point takes place on the northern coast of South America in the early 1740s. in what is now this city in Colombia that we refer to as Cartagena. When the British were seeking to oust the Spanish from Cartagena, but were bested by armed Africans. At the same time, the British were finding that the European settler class on the mainland was rather reluctant to be conscripted, rather reluctant to fight under the Union Jack, not least because they were busily expropriating the indigenous population from what is now Maine to the southern tip of Georgia. Because of that, that puts more pressure on London to put arms in the hands of Africans. Also, keep in mind that as we stare in the face of a referendum in Scotland in a few months that might lead to the secession of Scotland from the United Kingdom, keep in mind that Scotland only comes into the UK in 1707. There are major uprisings against London in the 1740s. The Scots are not necessarily seen as being politically reliable. We all know the story about the colonizing of the Irish, and they're not necessarily being seen as politically reliable, that is to say, to follow the wishes of the Union Jack. And this also puts pressure on London to try to enroll more Africans in their armed forces. And when they begin to send armed Africans to places like Massachusetts, where the settlers are already in the process of devising revolts, say in the 1760s, and the settlers are then oftentimes staring down the barrel of a gun wielded by an armed African, this was not pleasing to these settlers. It was enraging the settlers because they had embarked on a different model of development, which involved not putting arms in the hands of Africans, but basically enchaining and enslaving every African in sight. So there was this fundamental contradiction erupting between the settlers and London. And this culminates in June 1772 with Somerset's case, where it appears that London is moving to abolish slavery, not only in the British Isles themselves, but perhaps on the North American mainland. And this is part of the trigger that leads to an armed revolt against British rule in 1776, that leads to the formation of the United States of America. And I should say right here that given the kind of history that I've laid out before your audience, I think it is long past time to move beyond the creation myth of the formation of the United States, which I'm afraid has ensnared some of our friends on the left, which has led them to mischaracterize and misjudge the alleged progressive nature of this revolt, when this revolt was more akin to, say, the revolt against British rule in what was then Rhodesia in 1965, the revolt against decolonization. And 1776, as I tell the story, was a revolt against abolition. And as a result of trying to have a different characterization of the origins of the United States, it might help us to understand why the United States today is the hegemon of right-wing politics internationally, why the United States, despite how many of us would like to see it, is an anti-union citadel, and why it perpetually and continuously threatens international peace and security.
Gerald Horn, Moore's Professor of History and African American Studies at the University of Houston. His new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, Slave Resistance and the Origins of the United States of America. We'll take a short break and speak more with Dr. Horn. Gerald Horn is my guest. He teaches history and African American studies at the University of Houston. The European settlers in North America, the colonists, they see London moving toward abolition. They perceive London moving toward abolition. They see London using armed Africans, in some cases, against them. And they revolt. And I guess what I'm wondering is how we parcel out how we weight the different factors that motivated the settlers to revolt in 1776. How significant a factor among all the factors was, in your opinion, this concern over race, this concern that an economy established in North America, heavily dependent on slavery, based on slavery, on the enslavement of human beings, could be threatened by a metropole, by a colonial power, which had begun to move in the anti-slavery direction?
Well, what I find curious today in 2014 is how many of my progressive friends, bless their hearts, oftentimes use the phrase, quote, identity politics, unquote, to dismissively and derisively refer to everything but the original identity politics, which is the politics of whiteness that led to the construction of these United States of America. It's quite striking how, in distinguishing themselves from London, the settlers in what is now the United States sought to move away from the religious Cold War, that is to say Protestant versus Catholic, something that's represented in their vaunted Constitution's First Amendment, supposedly granting freedom of religion, although we all know that anti-Catholicism and anti-Semitism continued to pockmark these United States of America for decades going forward. But they also sought to move away from ethnicity, that is to say Irish, Scots, Welsh, English, to an overarching whiteness, which was much more convenient. For example, one of the problems that Spain had was oftentimes trying to colonize only with the assistance or at the tip of the spear with Catholics. And that obviously narrows your population base, to put it mildly. And then, of course, we all know, too, that there was the ethnic question in Spain as well, as represented by the fact that Catalonia might be having a referendum, too, in the next few months to pull away from Spain. And likewise, it was approximately 1714, approximately 300 years ago, that the Catalonian insurgency was squashed by Madrid. So part of the, quote, genius, unquote, of those who founded the United States of America was not their alleged attachment to civil liberties, which, by the way, never attached to the indigenous or the Africans after 1776, but this militarized identity politics, the ability to take Europeans whose roots were oftentimes somewhere in Europe from the Atlantic Ocean to the Urals, and incorporating them into this overarching white identity, which is something that's still in play and still in motion and has probably been the most successful, quote unquote, form of identity politics ever devised, which makes it even more curious that that term identity politics is rarely applied to it.
So whiteness was formulated, it was strategized in response to, in your opinion, the threat posed by Africans, by enslaved Africans, by armed Africans, by Africans in their midst?
There are scholars who I quote, and I try to build on their argument, that suggests that the invention of whiteness, if you like, is congruent with and concomitant with the rise of the African slave trade, the acceleration of the African slave trade, particularly in the late 17th century with the rise of what I refer to as free trade in Africans, when the Royal African Company, theretofore under the thumb of the monarch, takes a step back and free trade commences with the merchants and the private traders, as they're calling themselves, entering into this trade. And once again, these Europeans have a serious demographic problem. Oftentimes they're being outnumbered. They're always making a cry and a call for bringing more, quote, whites, unquote, to these shores. And what's interesting is that the term oftentimes goes curiously undefined. Certainly, this category of whiteness allows for the infiltration under the guise of whiteness of French and Spanish antagonists. But the argument I make in this book is that it also helps to give rise to a certain form of civil liberties. That is to say, in order to attract people to a war zone, which was what North America was in the middle of the 18th century, you had to make certain promises. You had to make it seem attractive to these European settlers. And of course, part of the attraction was that you could get land expropriated from the indigenous that could be worked by the Africans. And part of the attraction was also that you might have certain civil liberties that you did not necessarily enjoy in Europe. And this is all part of the package of the formation of the United States. And I would also go so far as to say this is part of a necessary project that we need to understand and study so that we can demythologize, if you like, the creation of the United States so that we can understand how and why it was that despite the fact that even some of our friends on the left claiming that the formation of the United States was this great leap forward for humanity, the fact of the matter is it was not a great leap forward for the indigenous people who, as we know, had their land taken from them from the Atlantic to the Pacific. It certainly was not a great leap forward for the Africans who, you may know, after the formation of the United States, the settlers in North America basically oust the British from the leadership of the African slave trade. And as a direct result, you see Britain moving towards abolition. Britain moves towards abolition decades before the United States does in 1865. Britain moves to clamp down on the African slave trade at the beginning of the 19th century and, in fact, becomes the cop on the beat, oftentimes helping to bring to account slave traders who were sailing in ships under the Stars and Stripes. As I note in my book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba during slavery and Jim Crow, one of the reasons you have so many Africans in Cuba is precisely because it was the United States slave traders who were bringing those Africans to Cuba. So it's very curious that this great leap forward for humanity that supposedly was the United States of America led to a pulverizing of Africans. And what's even more curious is that the United States is replete with analysts, scholars, professors, politicos who nitpick and scrutinize and assail virtually every revolution that's taken place since 1776, not least the French Revolution, Russian Revolution, Cuban Revolution. But they have nothing to say about the so-called American Revolution in terms of its downside. It's almost like there was no downside to the revolt against British rule. It was all upside, which is not only unscientific, but anti-dialectical.
Let's talk about the indigenous population, the Native American population in North America. What anxieties do the settlers have around blacks, around Africans collaborating with indigenous people and the threat that could pose to their ability to survive and thrive on the continent?
Well, certainly a strategic objective of the settler class in the British colonies on the North American mainland was to stoke animosity between the Africans and the indigenous population. This was particularly so in South Carolina, where the combination of the numbers of indigenous and Africans was putting a mighty challenge to European colonial rule. And quite frankly, approximately 300 years ago, almost led to the liquidation of the colonial settlement in the so-called Yamasee War of 1715 or thereabouts. Unfortunately, I'm afraid that at times, particularly after the formation of the United States of America, as I deal with in the concluding pages of this book, the settlers in North America were quite successful in stoking animosity between the indigenous and the Africans. That is part of the legacy, I'm afraid, of the Buffalo Soldiers, who, as you know, fought under the Stars and Stripes in what is now the western part of the United States and were central and essential in helping to liquidate indigenous polities, which I think was a blow against the self-interest of the Africans, because I think that one of the many lessons of North American history is that the formation of the United States of America at once was a blow against people of African descent, but it was also a blow against the indigenous population who, of course, lost their land. And what's also interesting is that we need to engage more in comparative history. What I mean is that oftentimes you'll hear people, even progressive people, talking about the alleged progressiveness in the United States of America without any reference to Canada, which did not have a revolt against British rule. And I think it's fair to say, in relation to the United States of America, basically has the cleanest dirty shirt. That is to say, there's racism in Canada. There was expropriation of indigenous people in Canada. But compared to the United States, there's really no comparison. And of course, interestingly enough, Canada today, despite the fact that it didn't have this grand revolution, has a national health care system, the so-called single-payer system that people in progressive movement are always talking about that they would like. And it has a social democratic party that actually rules provinces to the left of the U.S. Democratic Party, which is basically a center-right party. I'm talking about the NDP, the New Democratic Party. It's also curious, too, to look at Australia, which is very similar to the United States. I talked about the comparison between Australia and the United States in my book, The White Pacific, U.S. Imperialism and Black Slavery After the Civil War. And what's interesting is that Australia, whose history is very similar to that of the United States, although it didn't rebel against British rule, there is a thriving historiography in Australia that's critical of the expropriation of the indigenous population, that's critical of the violent implantation of white supremacy in Australia, that's highly self-critical. And what's interesting about the United States is that kind of self-criticism about this country, particularly its origins, is not necessarily even part of the progressive movement, even though this country, as noted, is the leader of the international right wing, has white supremacy and racism that's off the charts, disproportionately imprisons people on a level hardly seen in human history, and yet there's this creation myth that continues to persist.
One kind of broad historical argument you have in this book, and you've kind of alluded to it, is that in some ways the treatment of African Americans after 1776, before and after the Civil War, up till today, is based somehow on, and I'm going to try and put this as bluntly as I can, and maybe you want to add nuance to it, white resentment at the fact that at the time of the revolt of 1776, the Africans were, for many good reasons, essentially supportive of the British, right? The British who were moving toward abolition, who were using armed Africans. Is that your argument? And how do we assess that, given that so many decades, and in fact more than a couple centuries have passed since, you know, that struggle where you had white settlers revolting against London and their enslaved blacks not in league with the white settlers?
Well, this is how I would put it. As I say in the book, I think the term racism is a necessary but not a sufficient explanation for what has befallen people of African descent in North America. I would also argue that slavery, enslavement of African people, from which racism springs, in my estimation, is also not a sufficient explanation. The then Cuban communist leader Blas Roca in 1960 made an argument that few, I'm afraid, have made on the North American mainland. What he said then is, why is it in the Americas, where many of these nations had slavery, including Argentina, including Cuba, Brazil, Central America, Mexico, but why is it that the Africans in North America seem to be treated the worst, which was the case in 1960, yet you had this grand revolution? The point that I make in this book is that unlike Cuba, where there was a confluence of the struggle against slavery and the struggle against colonialism, as represented in the historic and heroic figure of Antonio Maceo, unlike Mexico, where you had something similar, as represented by the fact that a man of African descent, Vicente Guerrero, was a president of Mexico 180 years before Barack Obama became the president of the United States, that in what is now the United States, the struggle against slavery and the struggle against British colonialism were at loggerheads. And this helps to create a culture that leads to an intensified white supremacy, an intensified racism that continues to bedevil the United States of America. For example, there's a long footnote where I talk about how Angela Davis, the contemporary activist, talks about growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, the fortress of Jim Crow, how when she would try to escape the strictures of Jim Crow in Birmingham, she would go into the department stores and speak French. That's a frequent story told by African Americans. The black Philadelphia lawyer, now deceased, Raymond Pace Alexander, says the same thing with regard to speaking Spanish. James Weldon Johnson, a former leader of the NAACP, grew up in Jacksonville, Florida, speaking Spanish, says the same thing. In other words, there has been a special persecution of the descendants of enslaved mainland Africans, which is not to say that other blacks have escaped persecution, which is obviously false. You know, all you have to do is read the memoirs of black folk from Jamaica, like Colin Powell, for example, or the Trinidadian pilot Hubert Julian, for example. But it is to say that when you fight a war and lose, which is basically what the bulk of Africans did in 1776, you tend to get punished. And that's not only Africans. That happens all over the world. I mean, if you fight a war and lose and you're on the so-called losing side, well, not only are you punished, but your descendants are punished forevermore as an abject lesson. And that's part of what I'm saying in this book.
And maybe this follows on from the point you just made, but you argue in this book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, that counter-revolution, the affirmation of the necessity of slavery, made the explosion in 1861, made the Civil War virtually inevitable. How so?
Well, Robert E. Lee, the leading Confederate general, Jefferson Davis, and the other acolytes of the so-called, unfortunately, deceased Confederate States of America argued with some justification that they were following in the footsteps of 1776, because after all, 1776 was not an abolitionist formation, and they were arguing that they had the right to continue, not only continue slavery, but to expand slavery into lands that had only recently been taken from the indigenous population. And therefore, what I suggest is that the formation that was established in 1776, the so-called United States of America, it was not only beset by a tragic flaw, that is to say, enslavement and expropriation, but it was a design flaw. I mean, that's the way it was designed. And like any formation or any mechanism with a design flaw, oftentimes it crashes and burns. And that's what happened to the United States of America from 1861 to 1865. As I argue in the book already noted, Negro Comrades of the Crown, the United States was under tremendous pressure in the run-up to the Civil War from this de facto alliance between Africans and London. And there was a possibility, a la the War of 1812, that the United States of America could be deprived of its sovereignty unless slavery was extirpated. And slavery was extirpated, but as I also suggest, that too came with a price. That is to say, with the extirpation of slavery came a renewed, invigorated assault on the sovereignty of independent Native American polities. And sadly and tragically, many of the newly minted, quote, African Americans, unquote, felt that as part of their so-called citizenship rights, that they should enlist in this new crusade against independent Native American polities, which helped to push many of these Native Americans out of their lands in what is now the Western United States, and particularly in the state of California. I know I'm here talking about my books, but I would really like to mention this new book called Murder State, which talks about the attack on indigenous populations of California, which was tremendously bloody, tremendously ugly. And as a person who's lived in California, it's eerie how their presence is hardly discussed.
Gerald Horne, H-O-R-N-E, John and Rebecca Moore's professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Houston. We've been talking about his new book, The Counter-Revolution of 1776, published by NYU Press. Gerald, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time.